Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. It's the 22nd of March, and we're into spring now. So there we go. We have a season down, and we're into a new one, and it's a good one. So welcome. We're very happy to have you all here on this Monday morning. Well, so we are trying to... Okay, we're trying to get Malcolm Nance on the show, and I think Malcolm is calling in, so we should be all set and ready to go. But while we're getting him in and set, we'll welcome the rest of the group. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning, Joe, and good morning, everybody. It is a nice day out there. It was nice at 4 o'clock in the morning. Nice there. The bear is out. The bear is walking across the road, and I've been telling people, watch out for the bear. And one couple who doesn't really know Irving, that's his name, said to me, well, what do we do? And I said, you just keep walking. That's all. Just keep walking. All right.
Have you seen said bear yet?
I have. I saw the bear yesterday. I said, I'm lumbering across the road. And then I asked everybody who was walking on the road, did you see the bear? Thinking that they all would say no. And every one of them said, yes, we saw the bear.
That's great. Well, I mean, it's good that they at least were on look out for the bear.
Yeah.
So good morning to you. Good morning to Irving. Welcome. Immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you here with us. We thank you very much. Counterterrorism expert and bestselling author Malcolm Nance is in the house. Good morning, Malcolm. How are you?
Good morning. Hey, where are we seeing these bears at?
Alan?
The bears are on Lake Mansfield Road. I probably shouldn't say that because everybody would come out to see the bears. right where it meets Christian Hill Road in Great Barrington.
Wow.
So head on out.
The Barrington Bears.
You can have
the Barrington Bears. I love it.
The Barrington Bears. They all go out. They have a little picnic. They have that song. It's perfect.
And they find a bed that's just right.
Just right. Exactly. Libby Post is with us, political consultant and our dear friend. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Good to hear your voice and welcome you to the program. We also welcome everyone listening to the program as well. You can write to us any thoughts on anything that we're discussing this morning, any questions, any things you'd like to add to the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. It is an interactive program, or at least we try to make it be one. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll get to your letters in just a bit. Please make them short, keep them to the point, send them to the right place, and pre-read them before you send them. Those are the only big rules. Panel at WAMC.org. Okay, let us begin with what's going on in the world. We'll begin with the border story, which is... what we heard yesterday, the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas speaking yesterday on some of the Sunday talk shows saying the border is closed, defending Biden's immigration strategy. Mayorkas defended President Biden's immigration plan and emphasized it in multiple interviews Sunday that the southern border of the United States is closed as the Biden administration faces criticism over a record number of migrants seeking entry into the country from Mexico and Central America. Mayorkas, who appeared on almost all of the major political shows Sunday morning, sought a push to push a consistent message as the Biden administration is being pressed about conditions in overcrowded detention centers for unaccompanied immigrant children. The border is closed. We are expelling families. We are expelling single adults, Mayorkas said on NBC's Meet the Press, adding that unaccompanied minors should not attempt to make any journey to the U.S.-Mexico border now. We strongly urge, and the message is clear, not to do so at this moment. I cannot overstate the perils of the journey that they take. Alan, we'll check in with Sienna in a moment on this, but your thoughts first.
Well, I can't wait to hear what Sienna has to say. I mean that. In my case, I have to say, I don't know what I do. I mean, this is a very difficult situation. You can't let everybody in who wants to come in. Biden clearly knows that Trump suffered a great deal because his reputation of being mean to kids or being intolerable to children really left him in a very bad shape, both morally and because it's politically. So they are struggling. The Biden people are struggling to find the proper way out of this. If you say to a kid, you're allowed to come in, but your parents aren't, do the parents just take the kid and basically shove him across or her across the border and say, okay, my sacrifice is to my kid who should grow up in the United States? And with that, I pass to Sienna.
Sienna is an immigration attorney. How do you look at all of this as it's unfolding?
Well, we will say that no one in the immigration community is surprised by this, right? We knew that the minute the Biden administration was in office, that we would have a push of immigrants coming to the U.S. A lot of people have been held outside the U.S. A lot of people have not. A lot of people are fleeing hurricanes, poverty, violence, and they have been trying to figure out how to get into the U.S. We've been seeing more immigrants coming through the Canadian border without inspection. So we've been dealing with those issues because the Trump administration was so focused on the southern border. So it did not surprise any of us that we would have this influx at the southern border once the Biden administration was in office. The problem is, and I've been saying it from the beginning at least, is that the Biden administration has not, because COVID obviously is the priority, but they have not been making strides in the immigration field as many as we expected. And we thought they had a better plan in place to deal with the immigration issue because it was a huge issue, a huge policy. There were huge policies made in the Trump administration to curtail it. So we've been up until the last week of the Trump administration, the immigration attorneys, the immigration field, we were still dealing with restrictions coming down from the Trump administration in the immigration field. And so we thought that the response that the Biden administration would have a faster, swifter response to those policies. And unfortunately, the rollback has been so slow that, of course, they can't deal with the influx of individuals coming in. I mean, the amount of time that it even took them to get the Department of Homeland Security together and have someone appointed was just a little disappointing. It was a priority. And the fact that we just got Merrick Garland in, I mean, I know that has to do with confirmations, but they had to know this was going to be a big issue based on how the Trump administration.
So what should, Sienna, Biden be doing right now? I mean, I certainly agree with you that, and lack of preparation, the rest of it, but what's the proper thing to do now?
Well, what needs to happen is I think they're focusing, obviously, we always know it's hard on the border states to deal with the influx, but just like in 2014, you have to get those kids out of Texas. You have to get those kids out of New Mexico quickly because there are other organizations around the country that can help deal with this. The problem is that they're not moving them fast enough out to other states. There was a time when they were, flying them up to even Albany at some point. We had a lot of people. It wasn't unaccompanied minors. But there are facilities that are waiting and that can assist with this. But they're all over the U.S., and we have to have they need a better system to get them flown out of that Texas and get them out, bottleneck, and get them out into the other parts of the country and then process them there. Because that's the system that we had in place prior to the Trump administration.
So this idea of the border being closed to me is to catch up, right? But how long does that happen and when do you get things, quote unquote, under control?
First of all, I'd like to state that the border being closed, in my opinion, is almost a violation of international human rights. Like, it's just the idea of closing the border as an immigration attorney is just abhorrent to me. But I just really believe that you have to, I understand what they're trying to do in light of the COVID pandemic. And I believe the Department of Homeland Security, I believe the secretary said that they're still allowing unaccompanied minors to come in. I don't think it's closed to everybody. I think the minors are still able to come in. And I think that's a huge distinction. And that's important for our international communities to know. Because you guys have to remember, we're looking at it from U.S. citizens looking out and seeing this influx coming in Texas. And we're just, all up in arms about all these children. But for the international community, what does it look like to have the U.S. close the southern borders to people in need? I mean, it's just, it's a huge issue internationally and globally.
Malcolm Nance, your thoughts on this?
You know, it's very interesting, but Republicans, when they bring this issue up, they're just so good at framing the entire basis of the existence of the United States as a nation of immigrants as the worst thing that has ever happened to the country. I mean, they're really, really good at making things that are good for America sound bad, simply because they have the ability to craft these micro narratives, right? So they fully intend, from what I'm seeing now, to use this subject, immigration, again. It was kicked off by Trump yesterday, for those of you who are ignoring the former guy. So the former guy said on Fox News that it was a disaster. America is going through a catastrophe. It's the exact same thing that he said in 2015 and 2016. And he'll continue to say. So here's, I'm going to give the Democrats a hand here. All right.
Right.
Here is the meta narrative framing Democrats should be using to frame up what Secretary Mayorkas was trying to say yesterday very clearly. The border is closed, but not cruel. And that's what U.S. policy should be. We should be as secure as possible, but there's no need to be cruel to people. And that is a Republican policy platform, right? Be cruel. The Trump administration, Homeland Security Department, and his national security team all said that was the policy. Jeff Sessions said that. The policy was to make it so awful that people wouldn't want to come to America. Well, the only way that you can make it more awful is to be as racist as possible and to hurt children and lock them in cages. And the Bush administration did a good job of that. You know, it's a double-edged sword. These people are coming to the United States because it's a nation of opportunity. No policy is ever going to stop that. None. People, it's always better here than someplace else. But there's no reason to say that we have to be absolutely ruthless towards them. And I think Biden, if he picks up that message, it'll resonate very well.
Libby Post.
I don't have a lot more to add other than it's the same, like Malcolm said, it's the same old trope from the Republicans. It's about the only thing that they can latch onto right now as a negative from the Biden administration. And, you know, Santa's right. The delay in putting in the cabinet has added to this problem. But let's be real here. And I know the Republicans are never going to say this. This problem started with Donald Trump. I mean, immigration has been an issue in this country forever. I mean, you know, when my grandparents came and other people's, you know, most of us are immigrants in some way or descendants of immigrants. But Donald Trump exacerbated this with his painful and evil and hurtful and policies. And the GOP really is the party of pain, inflicting it on others. And so it really started with him. And so for them, once again, the disingenuous way that the Republicans turn things around to accuse others of what they've already been doing. And this is another example of that.
Yes, yes, Libby, but what would you do if you were Joe Biden?
What would I do if I was Joe Biden? I would put more resources, if possible, I would put more resources down at the border and try to, you know, there are plenty of lawyers, as we've seen at the airports when Trump put in his travel ban in, to see if we can get more lawyers down there on a volunteer basis. I mean, it'll cost money, but to try and alleviate what's going on down there and see if we can expedite some of this, these asylum seekers. And I think, you know, we saw what happened when parents were separated from their kids. And so to let the kids come in by themselves, you know, I mean, as teenagers, it's one thing, as younger, it's another. It's, this is not an easy answer. There's no platitudes, no, you know, snap my fingers and this is what's going to happen. And this will make it all better. That's for sure.
I will say that there was a program called the Central American Minors Program. And this program allowed minors to apply in their home country to come into the U.S., to be paroled into the U.S. And this helped a lot with the unaccompanied minor issue. So if a parent felt that the child wasn't safe or a child didn't feel safe, there was it was similar to a refugee resettlement. They could apply and see if they could send their child safely to the U.S., to a safe place. That program was dismantled by the Trump administration in 2017. And so that is programs like that that we need as well, right? Because they are dealing with issues in these other countries. We can't ignore that. When my clients come through the door, you know, they're running from something. They're not, you know, they would not come all the way up through us from South America sometimes, but some mostly Central America, up through to Mexico. It's not an easy journey. It's not an easy journey. It's a dangerous journey. And I think we have to also consider that, the other side, where they're coming from and what we can do there.
All right, we're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our panel. We welcome your input as well. Alan Shartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Malcolm Nance, and Libby Post. Later on this morning, we'll be joined by pediatric immunologist Jim Fagan to talk about the coronavirus and give us an update. That in just about an hour. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And again, we will continue our conversation and include your letters after our news break with the BBC. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a lot of letters this morning, so I want to get to those right away. We welcome you back to the program, Alan Shartok, Malcolm Nance, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Libby Post, all with us this morning. Okay, let's go to the letters, and here we go. We begin with Judith. A friend in Tucson told me, Tucson is the name of the city, by the way. A friend in Tucson told me yesterday that they are building a huge tent city there and in two other cities in Arizona to help house these children coming over the border. I found that very helpful and reassuring, and wonder why that is not in the national news. Perhaps this is part of FEMA. Well, we have heard about that, Sienna, right?
Yes, absolutely. We have heard about it.
All right. Okay. Kimberly says, I feel that we need to address the issues in Central America that are causing people to flee their countries for hours. So how do we do that?
Well, we know that back in 2014, as part of the Obama administration, they sent, I believe they donated $75 million, I forget which country it was, but to just invest in Central America to try to deal with the situation when they had their influx during the Obama administration. In contrast, during the Trump administration, there was no investment in Central America. And now we know that every administration, we usually have one of these influxes towards the border, usually, but we didn't see a proper response in the Trump administration to deal with it overall. And so now we're dealing with it a lot in the Biden administration.
We have this letter from Erica. Why don't we have something like an immigration embassy in these countries, an office where citizens can go and apply? We would have Americans on the ground there so they could see exactly what is happening and why. Then they can report back to the U.S. so the government can get prepared for these waves, or set up immigration shelters in these countries with the same rules as the embassies, so these people are safe through the process. I think it's a terrible idea to keep sending more money to corrupt governments for them to take care of it.
Yeah, those are called U.S. consulates.
Exactly. That's just it. And the Department of State does issue reports every year on every country that they have access to, and they're allowed to do it. But these, once again, the important thing is that they're their own government. The U.S. can't go in and tell people how to govern. If the government is corrupt, then it's corrupt. I mean, that's just, there's not much we can do in terms of having them change their ways. In terms of, a lot of it is law enforcement. A lot of it is the cartels. People don't realize that. how much influence the cartels have. And these people are in fear of their lives from these gang cartels, and the government cannot control them.
Benjamin writes to us and says, is there any evidence the Democrats are interested in really protecting asylum seekers and immigrants? Yes, Trump was exceptionally cruel, but our most recent Democratic presidents, Obama and Clinton, were prolific deporters and border hawks. This certainly did not start with Trump in 2016.
I agree. There was an influx in the Obama administration of deportations. What the priorities were during the Obama administration was anyone with a criminal history, for the most part, we found them being locked up and deported. They went through immigration court proceedings. In the Trump administration, anyone that was here without status was locked up. That's the big difference. So we were seeing people, individuals who had families and had young U.S. citizen children, 3 or 4 children, the mom is being locked up. There's a huge difference between someone who's broken U.S. law being locked up and a mom of 3 U.S. citizens being locked up. And now her and her 3 U.S. citizens have to go back to Guatemala or El Salvador. And there's a huge difference in the policies.
You know, can I put it this way?
Yeah.
I think the Obama policies, which we're now going back to, was immigration control. And I know Department of Customs and Border Patrol, they had mandates not to go around and pick up non-immigrant or immigrant non-criminal people from their work, from school, from their office, pretty much leave them alone. And the Border Patrol people I know said that that was earth-changing for them. They weren't hunting people left and right. Under Trump, that became a policy of anti-immigrant presence in the United States. Stopping it all, getting rid of everybody who wasn't from a white Scandinavian country.
Let's go to 2 back-to-back letters. One has the subject heading, Malcolm is wrong. The other one says, Malcolm is right. So we'll take those in order, I think. I agree with Malcolm on the narrative. My suggestion to help alleviate the backlog at the southern border would be to set up facilities in the Central American countries where the immigrants are coming in to help process and give a safe place for them to shelter while their cases are decided. Meanwhile, Michael said, did Malcolm just say that there is no better place to be than the United States? I would disagree. Canada, Australia, New Zealand are just a few of the other countries which offer a far better opportunity for immigrants. Malcolm.
You know, interesting. First off, I'm an American, so I think we're always awesome. Second, you know, I've been to Australia. I could have had residency in Canada and Australia. But, you know, my wife was French-Canadian, and I could have had a Canadian passport. But, you know, those are small countries. I mean, they're big in geography. Australia has phenomenally hard immigration laws. Just, you know, if you're not a millionaire under 30, don't even think of going there. They won't take you in, and you're free to spend your $1 million and leave. Canada has, you know, you come into Canada, you actually, you know, my wife would have to have paid for all of my Social Security and back taxes if I had come in for years, because they don't want you in their, you know, Social Security system, their pension system, just by arrival. So, yeah, this is a great country. Better than them.
I'll also know that a lot of the immigrants are trying to get to Canada. It's not funny. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get to Canada a lot of times because they hear how good the asylum program is in Canada. And there is a law that doesn't allow you to apply for asylum in Canada if you pass through the U.S., So a lot of them get stuck in the U.S. system, actually. But a lot of people are trying to get to Canada.
Libby, any thoughts on what we're talking about?
No.
Okay.
I mean, this is not my area. When we get to the other stuff, I have some thoughts.
Okay, good. Excellent. Well, you just chime in when you want to.
Okay. Not to worry.
I never am. Okay. let's go to this letter. This is from Kimberly. I think we read that one. I apologize. We go to Adrian, who says, Lawyers for Good Government, who mobilize lawyers at the airport, has ongoing efforts to send lawyers to the border. The obstacles, including the need for translators, the lack of meaningful access to their clients, and a Dickensian legal framework that makes it almost impossible to prove an asylum claim. Is that true, and what do we do about it?
Well, for a lot of the asylum claims laws were enacted, a lot of the case law happened under Attorney General Jeff Sessions. When he was in office, he narrowed the scope a lot for a lot of asylum case law, and he kind of threw out a lot of eligibility categories. And so now, with the new Attorney General being in office now, we should see that scope once again broadened. And so we're hoping that the asylum case law will be, you know, more inclusive soon. We have to wait and see.
All right, let's go to this letter from Charles. The immigration crisis we face now pales in comparison to the climate refugee problem that we will confront in the next couple of decades. It will be orders of magnitude worse. Ed says, immigration seems to have a multitude of factors that make it difficult to manage. The simplest solution to me seems to be to require U.S. employers to verify the work status of everyone they hire. Certainly, we can issue working papers to migrant workers and verify that each person hired has the right to work in the United States. Once the opportunity to work illegally in the U.S. disappears, I believe far fewer illegal immigrants will attempt to enter the country. What good is being here if you can't earn a living? Shouldn't the U.S. government improve their database and get it to actually work, adding teeth in the form of fines and criminal prosecutions to those employers who don't verify the worker status? Seems to be the only way to control illegal immigrants working in this country.
Let's be clear that every individual who works in the U.S. has to fill out an I-9, and the employer has to verify to the best of their ability whether or not they have authorization to work in the U.S. I mean, that's the best you can do without falling into the Discrimination Act, which you can't discriminate against someone based on their national origin. So employers are facing a fine line here where they can't request too much documentation. They can't tell you exactly what documentation they want. They just have to use their best judgment and allow someone to give them documentation to show that they're allowed to work in the U.S. I don't think the onus should be on employers so heavily.
Alan, how about this one? Tom says, everything being said about immigration presently has been said by Native Americans 400 years ago.
Well, yes, of course, we have had terrible history ourselves. But I have to say, this is no easy fix. Much of our audience doesn't like this conversation, and they don't like it because they want to let everybody in who wants to come in. Well, if you were Obama, if you were the Bushes, if you were, you know, Trump, or if you were this president, you would know that that doesn't work. You can't do that. You've got to make sure that the border means something. But if you say that, there are people who are going to call you all kinds of names. This is a very, very serious problem. And I wasn't kidding when I asked each of the panelists, what would you do? Because it's very difficult to come up with something. You can treat people more humanely. You can let their kids in. There are 15,000 kids right now waiting to be put somewhere or somehow. We are not returning. So it's a hell of a problem.
We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss. We welcome your input. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we'll be right back. Oh, some sad news from the world of politics. U.S. Representative Tom Reed of New York apologized Sunday for sexual misconduct following allegations that a former lobbyist made against him. He said in a statement he took full responsibility for his actions. Reed, who was first elected to Congress in 2010, said Sunday he would not seek election to public office in 2022. So the six-term Republican previously said he would not serve more than six terms in the House of Representatives, but he had been considering a run for New York governor next year. The accusations made by Nicolette Davis, a former lobbyist, were first reported by the Washington Post on Friday. Davis told the paper that during a 2017 networking trip in Minneapolis, a group including lobbyist and Reed stopped at an Irish pub in the city. She told the Post that a drunk Reed unhooked her bra from the outside of her blouse and moved his hand up her thigh. Davis, 25 at the time and a junior lobbyist for the insurance company Aflac, said she asked for help from a colleague sitting next to her who intervened and stopped Reed. Reed first denied Davis's account, telling the Post, "This account of my actions is not accurate." He declined to respond to further questions from the newspaper. But on Sunday, Reed backed down from his denial. He said while he doesn't recall the interaction with Davis, he believed her. "I hear her voice and will not dismiss her. In reflection, my personal depiction of this event is irrelevant. Simply put, my behavior caused her pain, showed her disrespect, and was unprofessional. I was wrong. I am sorry, and I take full responsibility." Two interesting side notes to this, one being that the congressman was very critical of Governor Cuomo, and as several women stepped forward to accuse Governor Cuomo of harassment, Reed had called for him to be impeached. Also, we should note that he said that he is now working on himself and that his alcoholism had taken over, and he has since received treatment for his addiction. So, but I'm curious, not so much about the charges, but I'm curious about what this means politically, both for the House seat, Western New York, so probably a Republican seat, right, Alan?
I would think so, yeah.
And also for to have yet another name go out as soon as it came in to possibly run against the governor.
Well, I thought you were going to name a third thing, which is the hypocrisy. It was not only that he could have kept his mouth shut, but what he did do was to go after Cuomo for doing exactly the same thing. Now, that, of course, is where he is, his real problem is, and really goes to his character. He knew what he had done. He knew what he had been accused of. Somebody better answer the phone. Not here, though. And he knew it. He knew all of that stuff. So that makes him hypocrite, you know, grandioso.
Libby.
Well, it is my phone that's ringing, but it just seems the timing of this seems so convenient. You know, you wonder how this story got out after Reed, you know, blasted the governor for similar allegations and behavior.
What do you
mean
by that?
Similar, because I don't think the governor ever unhooked anybody's bra, but. You know,
but what do you mean? What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? That you didn't know how it got out. In other
well,
words,
I mean, it's, you know, is it, is there now this a push among the invisible hand to get all of this out and all everybody, regardless of party, to put all this information out there so that. And it's mostly men, I would say 97% of the time it's a man, are held responsible for their actions, which I think would be great, you know, or was this, you know, was there politics behind this to get Reed out of the gubernatorial race? You know, the bottom line here, for me is that men who sexually harass, there's a reckoning, and it started with Me Too, and because the governor had stood up for women in so many ways and pushed an agenda that was pro-women, you know, Reproductive Health Act, Contraceptive Care Act, sexual harassment training, all of the stuff and legislation, and he took a fall, and I think you're going to see more of these guys taking a fall because women are now empowered. That's the bottom line here. Women are now empowered to speak out about this, even if it happened a number of years ago. And I think we're going to see more of this coming out in the coming weeks and months. And I think you'll see other people step back from politics because of it. I mean, I remember what it was like when I worked in the legislature, and Alan, you and I have had this discussion. There was one particular legislator, Mark Allen Siegel, who was horrible.
Infamous.
Unbelievably horrible. And no one was safe. No woman was safe. And, you know, this has been one of those unspoken, tittering little things that have gone on in the political process for a very, very long time. And I have to say, when I see the Republicans get up and rail against the governor around this, and the governor is not in the right in this either, but when they rail against it, when Nick Langworthy gets up and rails against the governor and sexual harassment and Bob Ort and the rest of them get up and do this, I'm like, you need to be careful what you wish for.
So here was Nick Langworthy's statement on this. It came out almost at the exact same time as Tom Reed's comments. I commend Tom Reed for taking real accountability for his actions. I believe he has made the right decision, and I hope this can bring some peace for Ms. Davis, who made very serious allegations that deserve to be heard. I wish Congressman Reed continued strength in his recovery from alcohol dependence and all the best for his family.
Well, isn't that lovely? You know,
but it also, I mean, the reading between the lines, Republicans are doing the right thing by resigning or not running again.
That is that. And we'll see how many more of those Republicans there will be to end up not running again, because this is not a Republican or a Democrat issue. This is a male power issue and a political power issue. It crosses party lines. It's nonpartisan.
Sienna.
Well, I agree with Libby. I think this is nonpartisan. It's disappointing to see them, you know, and by them, I mean the Republicans, you know, kind of highlighting this so much when they didn't do the same when Trump and what he was going through. I just find it all the hypocrisy overwhelming. So I think this needs to be dealt with at all levels in all parties. So that's where I stand. That's my position.
Malcolm, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'm going to pass on this particular conversation. I don't know enough about that politician, but boy, the hypocrisy is staggering.
We have two letters that I want to get to before we take a break. To all politicians, from Nancy, before you jump on social media and shoot your mouth off to call the kettle black, please go back through your own history and make sure you are not the pot. Idiots. Says Nancy. So there you go, calling out the hypocrisy. Linda is calling us out saying, oh my God, you're asking what the U.S. can do in corrupt/dangerous countries in Central America. You all don't seem to ask that question when Obama and now Biden wants to keep their damn noses in Afghanistan. And no discussion on where all the supposed parents who President Trump supposedly separated from their children are. Aren't they rushing into the U.S. to get their kids back?
Maybe Malcolm could talk about Afghanistan for a minute. Malcolm?
Yeah, I won't say it's a tough one, but all the indications are that Secretary of Defense Austin is going to extend U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And, you know, I served in Afghanistan. I'll tell you, the Trump administration's policy was insane. It was all about getting, I don't know, you know, back in the 80s, he tried to get himself a Nobel Prize by asking the Soviets and the U.S. to make him a negotiator on nuclear weapons. And this whole thing with Afghanistan, the promise of ending the endless wars, he literally was going to turn Afghanistan over to the Taliban straight. No in between going on there, which means, you know, by the end, if he had been reelected, by the end of this summer, it would have been the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. And I'm not too sure how well American people would like it at that point. So, and by the way, killing pretty much everybody who ever worked with us ever. So I think that we may have to keep forces in Afghanistan for a while. It's a question of capacity building. But let me tell you, ISIS is on the rise in Afghanistan. Their ISIS Khorasan division there is just attacking and mass murdering people left and right. Also, the Taliban have no problem with carrying out suicide attacks at critical moments under Trump, and they did it to check to see if Trump was really serious about giving them the country, and he was. So we could have been facing, you know, in a few months, people arguing, oh, my God, all these hundreds of or tens of thousands of Afghans who came and worked with us are now being killed or being put into camps. And what happened? You know, and it's as simple as, you know, you cannot just walk out of Afghanistan. It's graveyard of empires. You have to work your way out slowly and build a new Afghan force that will be able to maintain government.
Alan, did you want to say that?
No, you know, I wanted Malcolm to talk about it. And of course, as usual, he's done so brilliantly. But the question that we all have is what's on the horizon? I mean, Malcolm said, work our way out of this slowly. Meantime, we're spending billions of dollars, obviously. We all went and saw the Kite Runner. Is that was the name of it,
yep.
Joe? The Kite yep. Runner. And we know what happens when those people take over. You know, they're vicious. And so it comes down to American morality versus the amount of money and the amount of kids that we put over there to keep the peace. It's a very difficult situation.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, and Malcolm Nance. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock in just a few minutes. We will be joined by Dr. Jim Fagan. We're going to be talking about the coronavirus, so we're going to get in some other issues before Dr. Fagan joins us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and obviously a lot to talk about, so we'll go to all of that as I try to bring up the I'm having trouble loading the story here. I apologize. There we go. I got it. Only took a second. Okay, so I do want to talk about the Georgia hate crime law and what's going on there, why some Georgia lawmakers want last week's shootings labeled hate crimes. Violence that left 8 dead, including 6 women of Asian descent, will be the first stress test for a Georgia hate crime law. A year ago, Georgia was one of 4 states that had no hate crime legislation, but the deadly rampage last week that left 8 people dead, 6 of them women of Asian descent, is now providing a test of a law passed last year and a window into the way that the state's increasingly diverse electorate has altered its political and cultural chemistry. Georgia, after earlier false starts, passed its legislation following the shooting death of a young black man, Ahmaud Arbery, who was stopped, detained, and then shot to death by white residents in a South Georgia suburban neighborhood. Now, last week's shootings, in which Robert Aaron Long, a 21-year-old, has been charged with 8 counts of murder, are providing a major stress test for when the legislation can be applied, what it can achieve, and how it plays into the state's increasingly polarized politics. Alan.
Why should we believe this guy about anything? You know, he killed all these people of Asian descent. One and one makes 2. As far as I'm concerned, the police ought to be working on the presumption that he is a racist, that he is picking on people of, you know, of a particular kind of descent. And I'm just always upset when I read that the police or others think that they're, because he said it was something else, that he is to be believed. He shot 8 people.
So, Sienna, what stresses does it put on this particular law, the newly passed law?
I mean, what you're seeing is that they're trying to argue that basically that this is a free speech issue. And we have to remember that hate crime punishes acts and not beliefs. And basically what that means is if there was an act, then it needs to be punished. That's a hate crime. And the hate speech that went along with it, that's just another piece of the evidence that they present at the jury trial. And so there should be no reason why the prosecutors aren't charging this individual with the hate crime. There should be no reason, because that's the job of a prosecutor, is to charge. They can charge as many crimes as they want to, as long as they have probable cause. And then it's up to the prosecutor to also prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury. But at the very least, they should be charging him with a hate crime. You should start with, you know, as many as you can. And then sometimes it kind of whittles down during the jury trial process. And we understand that it's part of the justice system. But they need to be charging him with the hate crime at the very least.
Libby Post.
You know, it would be nice if hate crime law legislation included women. You know, oh, it was a sex addiction, so I targeted women. Well, if hate crime legislation had women as a protected class, then there wouldn't be a question. I mean, this man is a racist and he's using it as an excuse and all the rest of it. And yes, it should be a hate crime. He targeted Asian Americans and, you know, give me a break. But, you know, sexual violence against women is an epidemic. And here we are, you know, trying some people saying, oh, we had a bad day, which is the arresting officers. But, you know, he's trying to say I have a sex addiction and that's why I killed women because they were tempting to me. And so I killed them. And if that hate crime said, misogyny was also a hate crime, then there would be no question about any of this.
Malcolm Nancy spoke out pretty forcefully on this last week when we were talking about this issue shortly after it happened. But when it comes to this legislation and hate crime legislation in general, what do you make of it?
Well, you know, far be it for me to question other people's motives, but in Georgia, you really have to question a lot of motives. You know, I mean, every time they pass a law, and this law was passed by, you know, Republicans helped pass it, right? And now I think it might be a relatively easy dodge to charge this individual under the new hate crime law, which was passed after Ahmaud Arbery was killed, if only so that they could really run away from the point that this could have been an act of terrorism, which is something we haven't considered here. We really need to see more about the ideology of the individual shooter. But hate crime gives them a way to kick this right down the road. And, you know, I think it's great. I think it's great that there will be an upgrade from what we saw last week, which was horrific, which was them not justifying it, but at least explaining it away that he had a bad day. So, you know, I think it'll be good if we can do that. But, you know, as we say, we really need to finish this investigation and find out, you know, what else was going on in his mind? Was it religiously motivated? Was it, you know, I mean, was he radicalized in some other way, or was he following the political norms, or was it just, you know, as he said? So we'll find out. But, you know, yeah, go ahead and charge him. Let the district attorneys find out what he was really after and charge him with it.
Well, in the meantime, he's killed eight people now. Maybe his lawyer whispered in his ear. I'm saying maybe his lawyer whispered in his ear, stay away from the hate crime thing by just saying it was something else. And I think Libby makes a very good point. Why should it be different that a hate crime against people of Asian descent is different than people who are women, who happen to be women? I mean, it is beyond my understanding.
Yeah, I've never liked the term hate crime, only because it seems to be an intermediate step to quickly ramp up charges so that the actual underlying issue, like Libby said, violence against women. We have incel shootings, you know, these involuntary celibates who mass murder women, and they don't get charged with the same intensity. As the Washington Post noted, they said that this hate crime charge could just be used to gain leverage by the prosecutions so that they get a quick conviction, right? Or a quick, you know, that he pleads his way to 8 counts of life in prison. But I really think it's sort of a dodge of addressing that our criminal justice system does not value women and minorities in the same way if it's a white perpetrator. So, you know, hence hate crime legislation.
Sally, right? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And you can add LGBTQ people to that list as well.
Right.
Roger that.
Sally writes, when was the last time a person of color committed a mass shooting? Sienna.
Oh. I don't know off the top of my head. Was
actually,
something in California?
Well, no, but the point actually is a good one, right?
Let me make a point here. Actually, all the time. All the time. They're just not categorized in the same way as you see these particular mass shootings. So yeah, there, you know, you'll hear about shootings in malls and beefs at nightclubs. They do happen quite a bit, and there are a lot of black mass shooting perpetrators. It's their intent is not the same. They're usually criminal or personal. You know, they're not done in the same way. I wish we had Jim here, but they're not done in the same way with the randomness of it that many of the ones we see are.
I want to go to one other story here before we bring in Dr. Fagan, and that is Ron Johnson, Assaulting the Truth. Ron Johnson helps erode confidence in government. This is from a New York Times article, pushing false theories on the virus, the vaccine, and the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Mr. Johnson, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, has absorbed his party's transformation under Donald Trump. His revealing and incendiary comments, which quickly prompted accusations of racism, came as no surprise to those who have followed Mr. Johnson's career in Washington or back home in Wisconsin. He's become the Republican Party's foremost amplifier of conspiracy theories and disinformation now that Donald Trump himself is banned from social media, at least until he starts his own company, and largely avoiding appearances on cable television. Johnson incited widespread outrage when he said recently that he would have been more afraid of the rioters who rampaged the Capitol on January 6th had they been members of Black Lives Matter and Antifa. Malcolm.
You know, I really wish I didn't have to talk about this guy. We spoke about this last week. You know, Soledad O'Brien said he's a very intelligent gentleman. All of this is being done as part of his transformation to be the next Trump, you know, the supposedly smart Trump. Every word he said is a lie, a lie. And people should just come up and say, you're a liar. I mean, we all saw it with our own eyes that we saw you could watch the video of the Senate recessing because protesters were there attacking outside the building and had penetrated the building. Mike Pence was removed and his Secret Service detail had to evacuate them because they went into the Senate chambers. You can see them go through the desk and then sit there. You had the shaman, and that was all in the Senate. This guy is a flat out liar. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to whitewash this insurrection. And you know what? You know, maybe he has something to hide. Maybe the sedition conspiracy may extend to him or his staff. I don't know, but he is asking to be looked at with a much, closer microscope, based on the fact that he wants to cover for Trump and these insurrectionists with everything that he has, and it's disgusting.
Alan, what kind of political future does Ron Johnson have, do you think?
Well, Donald Trump got 73 million votes. That's a lot of people. And he wants to be the heir to that catch of votes, that's for sure. Whether he can do that, whether he is the same as Donald Trump, in other words, he didn't have a television show, he's another politician, Trump has been so discredited now that his trying to take on the Trumpian mantle may turn out to be bad politics.
All right. We want to get to talk about the coronavirus and bring in a special guest, Dr. Jim Fagan, who has been with us for a long time now, ever since this story broke over a year ago. He is a pediatric immunologist and joins us this morning to help us make sense of where we are here when it comes to the vaccine, when it comes to COVID and the concerns about variants and the like. Dr. Fagan, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm fine. Thank you.
Very nice to have you with us. So one of the big stories, of course, is the AstraZeneca vaccine, which we now learn protects fully against COVID-19's worst outcomes, according to a new study. This, as AstraZeneca is looking to, we've already made it available an announcement to make it available from the U.S. to Mexico and Canada. And now a large clinical trial in the U.S. Says that it has provided strong protections against COVID-19. This after Europe was still shaken and the giving of the vaccine was suspended because of concerns about possible rare side effects. So I asked two questions to begin. One is this fairly common when we are introducing vaccines, number one, and number two, how concerned should we be then about AstraZeneca?
I think the evidence shows that AstraZeneca is a very effective vaccine and certainly is on par with both Pfizer and Moderna in terms of preventing serious illness, hospitalization, and death, which is really what we want from these vaccines. You know, the question of possible side effects always comes up with any new pharmaceutical product. And I think it's very important to be able to discern what is a coincidental side effect that may occur in someone who has received a vaccine and has absolutely nothing to do with the vaccine, and to be able to discern that from a true vaccine-related reaction. When the data from AstraZeneca was analyzed, it would appear that the vaccine was not causing those rare thrombotic events with blood clots in those individuals. You know, I tell you, Joe, I think back to the Pfizer vaccine. You know, if you recall, the Pfizer vaccine, when the Pfizer vaccine first came out, it was first used in England. And on day one of administering the Pfizer vaccine, there were a report of three individuals who had anaphylactic reactions to the Pfizer vaccine. And that threw everybody up in the air and, oh, my God, what's going on here? And when it turned out that when you looked at the clinical trials, there was not a single person. There were almost, I think Pfizer had 40, 50,000 individuals in their phase three clinical trial. Not a single one of them had an anaphylactic reaction to the vaccine. And you know, I use that as an example of how these things can be, you know, misleading. It is, you know, the Pfizer vaccine has a excipient in it called polyethylene glycol, which can be allergic to certain people. The incidence of that is less than one in a million. And so, again, I think we have to be careful in terms of not pushing the panic button when there are reports of medical issues that develop in someone who's been vaccinated. Right now, as far as we know, the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccines are safe. They're very effective. You know, there are side effects to these vaccines, the injection site pain and swelling and redness. And then, you know, for a day or two, you can be fatigued and have headache and muscle pain. And those things are to be expected and are normal. And I always remind people that that's a good sign because it means the vaccine is working. So I think I'm glad that the European Medicine Agency made a strong statement about AstraZeneca, and it is being, as far as I understand, used again in most European nations. So I think it's a good, you know, we have not approved it yet, as you know, in the United States, and I have every reason to believe that it will receive, approval, emergency use approval in the United States as well. So I think it's a good vaccine, a safe vaccine, and certainly every evidence that it's a very effective vaccine.
Now, Jim, my question to you is, for those of us who have gotten the vaccine because of age and whatever else, and I think you're one of them, There is now a question as to what happens next. Should we continue to wear a mask? I believe we should, but I'm not that kind of doctor. So what's the answer?
The answer is absolutely unequivocally yes, you should continue to wear a mask. You know, the only way we're going to get back to a normal life is to reach that herd immunity level and to create enough immunity to this vaccine in the overall population so that the virus really has no place to go. And that's when it's going to die out. And that's where wearing a mask is so important. The vaccine, you know, it's interesting because the vaccine, and I think we've talked about this before, the vaccine, you know, it's designed to prevent serious disease, hospitalization, and death. Will it prevent a possible asymptomatic or low-grade infection? We don't really have an absolute answer to that question, and a lot of people will say, no, it doesn't. And we certainly, probably most of us know people who were sick with COVID-19 and then got reinfected, or those who, you know, had the vaccination now and then, you know, may have had a low-grade COVID-19 infection after that. I think that the wearing of the mask is really, really important in order to achieve that overall herd immunity. We want to stop the transmission of this virus, and also especially because of the possibility of mutations and the variant strains. And it makes it even more important that we all wear a mask, because that the mutation doesn't occur unless the virus infects a new person, gets into a new body, and that's when the mutations begin to arise. And if we can prevent that transmission, then we will certainly put a lid on the mutations of this virus and the variant strains.
And we don't know how long this thing is going to last, do we? In other words, we get the shot. But we don't have the slightest idea about whether it's 5 months, 6 months, a year, or forever. When will we find that out?
Time will tell.
Less than a minute.
And it's a new vaccine, and the overwhelming likelihood is that the immunity to the vaccine will last for probably a few years, and it's possible even lifetime. There is good evidence now that immunity, the immune response to the vaccine, is much better than the immune response to the natural infection, which is why we tell people who were infected with COVID-19 that they still need to get vaccinated.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Jim Fagan, pediatric immunologist. We will welcome your letters and thoughts as well on this subject. Panel at WAMC.org, if you would like to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. We just ask so we can get to as many as possible, that you keep them short and to the point and make sure they make sense, you know, all the good stuff. And we'll get to those in just a second. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 22nd of March. And with us, of course, Alan Chartok and pediatric immunologist Dr. Jim Fagan. We're talking about the coronavirus. Dr. Fagan, you mentioned just a moment ago as we began our conversation together about variants and the concerns over those variants. What do we know right now? We know that over the weekend we heard that there was one of the Brazilian variants that was present in a patient in Brooklyn. How concerning is that overall, and what should we make of such stories as we try to get this virus under some control?
Well, I think the problem with the variants is real. There's no question about that, and it is of a major concern. I mean, we're in a battle right now between, despite our evolutionary advantage, we're in a major battle between the genetic willpower of the SARS-CoV-2 virus to mutate in order to evade, the human immune response, and so there is real concern. There's no question that the majority of the variants that are currently present in the United States are very responsive to the vaccines that we have. So thank God for that. you know, the Brazilian, that P1 variant right. in Brazil is a nasty variant because it has been shown to be less responsive to vaccination. It tends to be more present with more morbidity and mortality. And it's a real concern. And, you know, I certainly hope that we don't see the P1 variant become a dominant variant, you know, in our country, because it will be a problem.
When we think about the rollout of the virus or of the vaccination, a lot of stops and starts. And how are things now, as you look at it as a physician? And I know it's hard probably to look at it globally and not just from the states that you right. work in. But how are things going?
Well, I think there's been a tremendous rollout, you know, in the past couple of months. We now, I think, have vaccinated almost 125 million people in this country, which is tremendous. I mean, that's really good. And so I think that in terms of the vaccination program, I think it's certainly going in the right direction. You know, again, our hope is that, you know, as we're vaccinating more and more people and more Americans are becoming immunized to this virus, the hope is that the virus will not mutate into a strain that becomes resistant to this vaccine. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. I know Moderna and Pfizer are being a little preemptive with that, and they're actually, you know, considering modifying their messenger RNA vaccines in the event that they need to. The nice thing about a messenger RNA vaccine is that it's readily easy to modify that, so to incorporate any new mutation that SARS-CoV-2 happens to engage in. And so that's encouraging. But I think overall the vaccination program in the United States is going well. Obviously, as you know, we still have, people who resist receiving vaccines and don't want to get vaccines for reasons that I can't even begin to comprehend. And we'll have to sort of face those issues. But I think overall it's going very well.
So do we look forward to a time, Jim, when in the same way we get a flu shot every year, we're going to get a COVID shot or a combination of different shots? In other words, doesn't this show the potential for having a proactive program about all of this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, Alan, and one that no one really knows the answer to. You know, I would hope it's, you know, from an immunologic perspective, that this vaccine that we're getting is lifelong and prevents reinfection with this particular strain of SARS-CoV-2. Obviously, the new mutant strains may arise, and that may, you know, change the landscape. You know, I think that we absolutely need to, you know, reach that level of herd immunity. With regard to, you know, do we need this every year? We'll have to wait and see. I think it would be unlikely, based on what I know about this right now, that we're going to need annual vaccines for, you know, SARS-CoV-2. It may be that every 2 or 3 years, you know, again, we don't know the longevity of the immune response to the vaccine yet. Time will tell. As I mentioned before, it seems that the longevity of the immune response to the vaccine is actually better, significantly greater than the longevity of the immune response to the natural infection. But we have to wait and see. I mean, if we, for whatever reason, if our immunity after being vaccinated wanes after 2 or 3 years, yeah, then we may need to have a booster shot every couple of years. You know, time will tell. We just don't know yet.
So you're a pediatrician. What happens to the kids now?
Well, yeah, that's something I'm really concerned about. You know, there's a lot of activity in terms of clinical trials. Pfizer is now has been studying children 12 years of age and older. You know, right now we know that if you're 16 years old, you can still get the Pfizer vaccine. You have to be 18 in order to get the other vaccines, the J&J and Moderna, and I think AstraZeneca is 18 as well. So Pfizer, you can get it when you're 16. But Pfizer, you know, is now engaged in clinical trials down to 12 years of age. And Moderna is engaged in clinical trials in kids as young as 6 months. Wow. And they're planning on enrolling almost 7,000 kids in the United States and Canada in that younger age group, and they're also testing kids 12 to 17. So I think that it's going to take a while because kids are just not small adults and they have different responses to things and including their immune responses, and so I think it is important that this be done properly so that when they come out with a vaccine we're all reassured that it's safe and effective, and that's critical. There's no getting around that, I wouldn't want to shortcut that, but I would think that probably in the next 4 or 5 months, we're going to see some significant changes. And I think I would not be at all surprised that maybe even in the fall, before school, kids 12 and older will be able to get the vaccines. And that's going to make a huge difference. I mean, I think that getting kids back to school is a major, 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 major priority. It's just heartbreaking to see what's going on, in terms of kids' social development and certainly their educational development and everything else. So I think that that's going to be critical. But I would say that probably by September, even earlier, we will hear some news about vaccinating kids 12 and over. And then hopefully in the ensuing couple of months, they'll be able to get it done. If we can start vaccinating kids 6 and older, I mean, that would make a huge, huge difference.
We have many, many questions from our listeners in the 6 or 7 minutes that we have left. So we'll try to get to as many as we possibly can. One is from Mary. Please explain how it works that if you have a reaction to the vaccine, that your immune system is working to prevent infection. And then if you don't have a reaction, your immune system is also working.
Well, Mary, that's a good question. And really, the honest answer is we don't know why some people tend to have symptoms after the vaccine, other people don't. If you don't have a sore arm and you don't have, a feeling of, muscle aches and pain, do not worry. It does not mean that the vaccine didn't work. And we don't, everyone's different and their immune response is different. And the inflammatory component of the immune response is different. And it's that inflammatory component that really is what determines whether or not you're going to have symptoms. So again, what I tell people is if you do have a sore arm or red, a little bit of redness in the injection site and a feeling of fatigue and headaches and muscle aches and pains, for sometimes nausea, don't worry about that. That's good because it means the vaccine's working. If you don't have those symptoms, that's not bad. You don't have to worry about, you don't have to think that, maybe this vaccine didn't work. The vaccine absolutely will work.
Larry writes, I've had my second Pfizer shot a week ago. I was expecting mild flu-like symptoms but had none. Is that indicative of my body's immune response or lack thereof?
No. Yeah. No, not at all. And again, it's what I said before. Some people have reactions to the vaccine and others don't. There's a lot of things that determine, what type of response you have. But you can rest assured, even if you did not have any symptoms after your first or your second shot, that does not mean that it didn't work. I'll use myself as an example. I had a really sore arm. I didn't feel so well after my first Moderna shot. I felt fine after my second one. Mm. And usually it's the other way around. So, everyone is different. Not to worry if you have, some mild symptoms for a couple of days, and certainly not to worry if you don't. It does not mean that the vaccine did not work.
Robert writes, my sister is saying that she wants to get the vaccine, but only wants to do it where a doctor or other medical personnel are readily available in case of a reaction. What is the difference in the staffing of sites such as a pharmacy versus a county or state site?
Yeah. My recommendation would be for her to get the vaccine whenever it becomes available, not worry about having, a doctor or a hospital staff around. The likelihood of a severe, what are we afraid of with this? The anaphylactic reaction, that allergic reaction, that's something of concern. Wherever they're giving the vaccine, they are trained and able to address the rare occurrence of a severe reaction. The likelihood of that occurring is minuscule. mean, we're talking about less than one in a million having a severe allergic reaction. That's the only thing I would really, you know, be concerned about. And I'm an allergist immunologist. And so that's the only thing. And as I said, it's extraordinarily unusual. The other stuff you do not have to worry about. I mean, the aches and the pains and the low-grade fever and that stuff that may develop the next day, and you may have that for a day or two, you don't have to have a medical personnel around. So my advice would be to get the vaccine whenever it becomes available. Do not be concerned about getting it in a medical facility or a hospital or a pharmacy would be great. You know, these clinics that they set up, you know, in the communities are wonderful. Don't worry about it. Get the vaccine.
All right. Some very specific questions from grandparents like Jane, who says, like many grandparents, we are now vaccinated twice and are looking forward to flying to get to meet our granddaughter for the first time. Would being tested after we arrive show if we carry some form of the virus that we could spread to her? Should we be quarantining after we arrive? Or would cleaning our clothes and taking a shower suffice before we hold her?
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming likelihood is that if they've been vaccinated, fully vaccinated, remember, fully vaccinated means about the 2 weeks after you received the second vaccine. At that point, it would be extremely unlikely, not impossible, but extremely unlikely that you would develop an asymptomatic infection and transmit the disease. You know, if the grandparents were, you know, were doing the right things and wearing a mask, you know, if they take a flight and wearing a mask through the flight and being careful about hand hygiene, as I'm sure they are, then there is no reason why they can't visit their grandchildren. And there, it's certainly not necessary to get tested before they see their grandchildren. It's certainly not necessary to change their clothes or take a shower. You don't have to do that. You know, if you've been fully vaccinated and you've been careful and you have no symptoms, of course, you know, if you do develop any symptoms that might be suggestive of COVID-19, then you should get tested. But if you have no symptoms, you've been fully vaccinated, there's absolutely no reason why you can't visit your grandkids and have a wonderful time.
All right. 1 minute for a final question. We go to Amy, who says, when will I know when my immunity wanes or doesn't exist anymore?
That's a great question. Yeah, well, we don't know. We have to find out. We will know the answer to that question, Amy. But, you know, the only way to know is to measure the immune response. And it's more than antibodies. It would be measuring cell-mediated immune responses, which no one's doing right now. It's very expensive to do that, and it would be, you know, sort of foolish to sort of engage in that kind of activity right now. But that's what's going to happen down the road. You know, it's going to happen, you know, periodically. They're going to have to look at people who've been vaccinated and 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, measure their immune response and see what the immune response of the population is. And that's the way that we'll know, you know, how long this vaccine actually works for.
Dr. Fagan, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us and taking time out of your schedule to do it. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Joe. Thanks for having me back.
All right. And, Alan, we want to thank Sienna and Malcolm and Libby for being with us as well. And, Alan, thank you, of course.
And we're always working on those phones. But remember, folks, we're doing what we can. Right, Joe?
Absolutely. Was there a problem today?
No, we got one letter.
Somebody
said, yeah, okay.
Okay, right. Gotcha. All right. We'll be right back with the Congressional Corner right after this.